Welcome to Whiskey Cast, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 231 for December 20th, 2009. Coming up in a few minutes.
I decided it would be an interesting thing to pursue the trail that Alfred Bernard had made in 1888 and try to photograph the various distilleries that he described more than 100 years ago.
That's Ian McIlwain, author of the new book, Bottled History. He went behind the scenes to find some of the secrets and stories hidden in Scotland's distilleries. More with Ian in a few minutes, along with the calendar of events, the emails of the week, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department. First, though, let's look at the news. Bonhams wrapped up its global auction of the Folsom collection of whiskies this past week in New York. Willard Folsom collected more than 3,000 bottles of scotch between 1988 and his death in 2006. And it took three separate auctions in Edinburgh, Hong Kong, and New York to sell the collection. Some of the New York highlights, a 50-year-old Dalmore and a 50-year-old Balvenie each sold for more than $7,100. An Ardbeg 1974 sold for just under $6,000. A four-bottle lot of Macallan Spey malts from 1938, 1940, 1950, and 1967 sold for almost $3,600, as did a 60-year-old Royal Bracla distilled in 1924. There were also several Black Beaumont bottles that sold for around $2,700 each, well below the results of other recent auctions around the world. Just a note, these are the top sellers. In fact, many of the lots sold for well below $300, and in some cases, less than the current retail prices for some bottlings. A few weeks ago, I mentioned that the first English whiskey distilled in more than a century is about to go on sale. The first spirit distilled at St. George's Distillery in Norfolk has now reached 3 years of age and is being bottled. The demand is so strong that the distillery has shut down its online shop until after New Year's. I'll have more on this in an upcoming episode. Highland Park has finally released its Earl Magnus Edition 1. I mentioned it briefly earlier this year. It's a cask-strength 15-year-old malt named after Earl Magnus, a mythological figure on Orkney. It'll only be available at the distillery and key UK retailers. There is a second edition planned for about a year from now. La Maison du Whisky in Paris has become one of the leading retailers of Japanese whisky anywhere outside Japan, and now it's taking that to an extreme. LMDW has opened a satellite store on Carrefour de l'Odéon in Paris, and from now until January 16th, it'll be selling strictly Japanese whiskies, including a few usually found only in Japan. The store's format will change after January, but what it'll sell next, only the folks at La Maison du Whisky know for sure. Researchers at Brown University have been studying hangovers, more specifically, whether some drinks are more likely to cause them. Their findings would seem to indicate that whiskey, beer, and wine are more likely to cause hangovers than clear spirits like vodka. The study blames congeners, which are organic byproducts of the fermentation process, and found more often in whiskey and wine. The researchers wanted to find out whether congeners add to the usual side effects of drinking alcoholic beverages. Personally, I'd rather drink something with flavor and depend on being responsible to avoid the hangover. Finally, it's time to announce the winner of the Knob Creek Bourbon display bottle signed by Fred Noe. I selected Matthew McFadden of Glasgow, Scotland at random from subscribers to the Whiskey Cast newsletter. Congratulations, Matthew. I'll have another competition coming up soon. You can sign up for the newsletter at the Whiskey Cast website. Time now for the Letter of the Week, brought to you by The Barrel Mill. I received some very nice emails this week with compliments about the show. Thanks to Jill Ann Vick in Germany, Romero Diaz in Austin, Texas, and other folks who took the time to send emails. I really do appreciate your kind words. Thanks also to Jason Peckman of Denver, who sent this email. Dear Mark, thank you for the Whiskey Cast podcast. I did not drink whiskey until New Year's Eve 2009, and I find your podcast and website very informative. How can I determine if a whiskey is available in the U.S.? I'm very interested in purchasing the Amrut Fusion and Glendronach Revival, but it appears to me that neither is available in the U.S. at this time. If I'm wrong and can purchase either whiskey without a $50 shipping fee, please enlighten me. Well, Amrit Fusion is expected to be available in the U.S. in the first quarter of 2010. And Henry Price of Price Imports helped answer Jason's question about the GlenDronach revival. Henry is the U.S. importer for GlenDronach and says the first shipment of the 15-year-old revival has just arrived in the U.S. this week, along with the 12- and 18-year-old GlenDronachs. Since it's so close to the holidays, the malts should start going out to distributors and then on to retailers in early 2010. Henry, thank you for helping me answer Jason's specific question. And Jason, when it comes to finding out whether a specific whiskey is available in the U.S., the easiest way usually is to check directly with the distiller. Most have an email link on the website and are usually pretty good about answering specific questions like yours. You can also check with major U.S. retailers like Park Avenue Liquors in New York or Binney's in Chicago. If a whiskey is available in the U.S., they'll generally know about it. If you have a question about whiskey, email me and I'll try to answer it or find someone who can. My email address is comments@whiskeycast.com. Now, it's too close to Christmas to get gifts delivered from my friends at the Barrel Mill in time, but it's not too late to take advantage of the 10% discount they're offering WhiskeyCast listeners. Just use the coupon code WC when you place an order at the Barrel Mill's website through New Year's Eve to save 10% on your entire order. They have everything from barrels for aging whiskey, wine, or beer to barrel tables and other gift items. Take a look at www.thebarrelmill.com to get some ideas. I want to thank Richard Hobbs and everyone at the Barrel Mill for sponsoring the Letter of the Week for the last several weeks. Now let's look at the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. Canadian Mist's Science Behind the Cocktail Tour stops in Knoxville, Tennessee on January 7th. The Chelsea Wine Vault in New York City will hold a whiskey tasting class on January 19th. The Tollbooth Tavern in Edinburgh will host Jolly Topper tastings on the 7th and 21st of January. Proof on Main in Louisville's monthly Bourbon and the Girls tasting is set for January 20th. And I'll be taking WhiskeyCast on the road to the Victoria Whiskey Festival in Victoria, British Columbia, the weekend of January 22nd through the 24th, with a live webcast from Victoria on the 23rd starting at 3:30 p.m. Pacific Time. That's 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time and 23:30 GMT. You'll find a complete calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig. Just click on the Laphroaig banner at the WhiskeyCast website to become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Isla. It's time for another chapter of the WhiskeyCast Book Club. I saw a great review in the winter edition of Malt Advocate magazine for Ian McIlwain's new book, Bottled History. Ian is a retired psychiatrist in Aberdeen, and he's turned to writing and photography with a focus on whiskey.
Well, I've been a whiskey drinker and a photographer all my life, and I came up to Aberdeen in Scotland from England in 1967, and I was introduced to whiskey, particularly malt whiskey, very early on. And when I was due to retire as a psychiatrist 5 years ago, I was starting to think about what I would do with my time, and I decided it would be an interesting thing to pursue the trail that Alfred Bernard had made in 1888 and try to photograph the various distilleries that he described more than 100 years ago. But like so many things, I started off doing one thing and I ended up doing something slightly different.
Now, the book takes an interesting take on Barnard's book in terms of both the photography, which is excellent, but also in terms of some of the stories you tell in here with some of the characters that you find at the distilleries.
Sure. Well, I went first. I was doing a project for an outfit called Aberdeen Industrial Doctors, who asked me to take photographs of all the organizations that they dealt with, and one of them was a distillery group called Inverhouse. And I went first to meet the manager of Knockdo, which is not very far from where I live. And he was extraordinarily interested in what I was doing. And he showed me bits of the distillery that were hidden and that people don't normally see. And he said, why don't you interview some old men? Because they'll have stories. Every time distillery managers get together, they talk about stories of what happened 30 or 40 years ago. And I thought, what an amazing idea. Fantastic. And as a psychiatrist, I was very used to talking to people who speak very broad North East Scots anyway. I've been doing it for a long time. So it caused no problems for me in understanding them. But I put a dictionary into the book because a lot of the words they use are really quite difficult for English people, leave alone people from outside the UK.
You also take a look at the trying to preserve some of the traditional practices, at least for future generations in this book, too.
Yes, indeed. I mean, there's an underpinning of a belief that traditional methods do lead to better quality whiskey production. I've had some disputes about this with people, as you can imagine, but I think that I've been making beer myself for about 15 years from scratch, from all the natural ingredients, and I'm very aware of how quite small changes in procedure can affect the finished product. And I think my belief is that doing things in the older way, in the more traditional way, like malting your own barley on the floor of a distillery, does lead to a superior product. But a lot of managers and the owners of the distilleries would disagree with that very strongly, but it's untestable.
Your previous background was as a psychiatrist, correct?
Yes.
What did you discover when you were talking to these guys and visiting the old distilleries? What did you discover that only a psychiatrist would have some insight into, or did you?
That's a difficult question to answer. I suppose I'm quite used to putting people at their ease relatively quickly. You know, as a psychiatrist, a lot of the interviews I had were very time limited, so I had to win somebody's trust in half an hour sometimes. And I think when it comes to doing that with one thing I discovered is that if you give them a couple of drams at the beginning of the interview, that certainly leads to a more interesting interview. There's an old guy who's particularly well known in Islay, who came off the bus to see me at Brookladdy, and he said, I need my sweetie first before I talk to you. And I said, what's your sweetie? And he said, oh, well, you see, you come with me into the shop. So we went into the shop, and the sweetie consists of having these two young women in the shop putting their arms around him and giving him a dram in each hand. So once he'd had his sweetie, he was only too prepared to talk. Not a problem. So whether it's my skills as a psychiatrist or the fact that I was prepared to lubricate him a little, I'm not sure. But they talk very freely and very happily, most of them.
What of those stories can you share with us?
Well, there are things like, I think one of the things is somebody said ruefully to me, you know, when I was a young man, we used to be in awe of all the old men, because they would sit around telling these stories of how things were when their grandfathers were in the distilleries and these sort of things. And we as the young men would be quiet. We would be kind of awed by this these amazing tales coming out of these men. But now it's totally different. He said, now I'm the old man, and the youngsters aren't interested at all in me. All they're doing is talking about what football match they've seen last night or what they saw on TV, and actually taking an interest in me is the last thing on their minds. I think I had interviews with people who talked to me about their wartime experiences, which were very interesting in the distilleries, particularly in Dufton, when most of the distilleries were shut down and there were a lot of people from, basically people interned, Italians and Germans who were living in Scotland were interned, but some of them were put to work in the distilleries, and there were all sorts of tales that came out of that. There were things about the old practices, the parts of the equipment that I found when I was looking for it is still there in many of the distilleries. It's extremely expensive to take this enormously cumbersome equipment out, and the land prices in Scotland are, at least in the remoter areas, not that high, so they don't bother to take it out. They just leave it there. It's all mothballed. And the old guys talk to me a lot about the salad in boxes and the old ways of turning malt over, which went out in the late 70s. That was very interesting, all the sort of the jokey atmosphere. And the other thing, I suppose half the stories I was told were to do with smuggling the product out of the distillery one way or another. So it was an enormous, the whole of Speyside consisted of a barter economy, really. So the white spirit, the pure spirit, came out in, bucket loads, really, hundreds of gallons of white spirit, and were exchanged for everything from potatoes to getting your car tested for road safety to anything. You know, it's possible to use white spirit as a currency. And they found all sorts of amazing, ingenious ways of getting the stuff out. I mean, in the silent season, when the places are all shut in the summer, some of the people would install special tubing into the spirit safe so they could suck it out or siphon it out during the night. Another one told me of the barrels being offloaded from the ship that used to bring them to Isla. And they would roll the barrels towards the distillery, the empty barrels. And, of course, some of them weren't empty. There were quite a lot that had still several gallons of proof spirit in them. So they would put an X on the barrels that were interesting and then return late at night with suitable equipment for decanting the contents. So you get all sorts of amazing yarns. Some of them have ended up in the book. I was a little bit careful that I didn't put the most extreme versions in because I didn't want people to get into trouble for what they were telling me.
I think the statute of limitations has long since expired on a lot of those, but I saw one of the quotes that's in your book refers to whiskey being like a prisoner of war, right?
Absolutely, yes. It has a tendency to try and escape at any opportunity. There's an interesting tale about Banff, which some of your listeners might be aware of. It shut in about 1980, and it was completely dismantled. So there's nothing left at all, no evidence that a distillery was ever there. And they had huge warehouses that had to be taken to pieces. And the contents, there were a lot of casks stored in the warehouses. And the contents, they discovered that any cask that could be reached on a ladder was more than two-thirds empty, which would suggest that the population of the surrounding area had been kind of helping themselves liberally over a long time, so there was virtually nothing left.
Not a surprise on that.
A bit sobering.
So to speak, yes.
Yes, so to speak.
So in visiting all these distilleries, did it affect the way you pick the whiskies that you drink now? Do you have favorites now that you discovered from the trip?
Yes, absolutely, it did. It's going to sound rather biased, really, but I can't help coming to the conclusion that the people who are using the most authentic, the most uncontaminated ways of making the whiskey do end up with a very superior product. Springbank and Highland Park are the two things that spring immediately to mind, I suppose, mm-hmm. That are both using traditional floor maltings, and all their equipment as much as it's always been there. It's partly because they're so far away from the centres of population that I think they've got away with it. You know, the big companies are less interested in changing distilleries that are really very remote. The ones that are much more central have been automated and mechanised a long, long time ago. And there is actually one relatively new distillery which can be run without any workforce at all. It can be run remotely, entirely by computers from outside. I find it difficult to believe that something that is that automated is going to produce whiskey that's of equivalent quality to what comes out of a very old-fashioned process. But maybe it can. I don't know. Maybe I'm just biased. I don't know.
And you really wanted to capture those old processes
absolutely.
in the book because
absolutely.
I noticed that there are distilleries that are not mentioned here that are very famous distilleries.
They're too clean. I wanted my distilleries to be photogenic, and there are a whole group of distilleries that have been scrubbed to death. I mean, they are so clean you could eat your dinner off the floor. You know, that includes Auchentoshan, Glengoyne, Glenmorangie, Glenfiddich, big names, really big names. So I went round these distilleries, but I could not find any old equipment. I couldn't find any quiet corners covered with cobwebs. You know, it was too scrubbed for me, and quite a lot didn't get in because of that. I have put a list at some point of the ones that got eliminated because of that. The ones that there are real gems that I discovered that are amazing places. Places like Ardmore and Balblair, which are not very well known at all, and which don't have visitor centres, and have extremely old-fashioned equipment and all interesting corners for me. Bladnock is another example. And they were of... I found them very photogenic, easy to find equipment that was extremely interesting to show up in a good light. And that's the kind of thing I was looking for. But I think there are a lot of places that have been automated to a point where they will make nice pictures of shiny stills, but then you can get lots and lots of books of pictures of shiny stills, and I didn't want to just replicate what has been done so many times. I wanted my take to be rather different from that.
What did you learn in this whole process?
To respect the spirit, I learned the workforce are amazingly friendly and hospitable, far more than I imagined they would be. I mean, on the ground, people were so helpful to me. And, you know, I was often left thinking, who's doing who a favor? You know, they were helping me, but I often came out with a bottle under my arm and all sorts of things and invitations to come back and all sorts of things. So it was very nice. It was very gratifying. And it kind of... I rediscovered how beautiful a country Scotland can be. I think for people in the UK, we often have a love affair with Europe. We go, you know, we go to the mountains in Switzerland, or we go to Italy, or we go to Spain, or whatever. But actually, we've got some of the most beautiful landscape in the world on our doorstep, and a lot of the distilleries are like that. I can actually reach, from Aberdeen, where I live, I can reach nearly 50 distilleries in 2 hours' drive from here. So I've got a lot of choice.
What's next for you?
I've got a whole... One of the things that's happened unexpectedly, I suppose I've found myself accepted into the body of whiskey writers who've been incredibly helpful and friendly to me. And quite a number of them have come up with suggestions of bits of collaboration. Hans Offringer is interested in doing something with me. I just went to Leiden in Netherlands for their whiskey fair last month, and a whole lot of people started to talk to me about things that we might potentially do together. So I don't know. I certainly will stick with whiskey, and I certainly will stick with photography, and I'm also interested in talking to more people. I'm perhaps going to do something about the components and taking a more detailed look at the various components that are put into whiskey and where they come from. It's been done already, but not photographically, not in the way that interests me. And I've done several commissions off the back of the book. I've done one for Springbank and one for Bruichladdy, and I photographed the reconstruction of Glenglassaugh over the last year, which was very interesting. They had the foresight to employ a photographer to actually record what it was like putting a whiskey distillery back into operation again, and I think that was a very sensible thing to do, and I'm very glad that they chose me to do it.
And on that note, as a photographer myself, the pictures in this book are stunning.
Well, thank you. All taken with a Hasselblad, with a digital back. So they should be good, and they are capable of being blown up. There's something about a Hasselblad imagery that is very, almost like a painterly quality to the images, and that's what I tried to get, sometimes successfully, sometimes not. You know, there are stronger pictures and weaker pictures in the book, but most of them I'm pretty proud of, really. So thank you for your praise.
And how can people order the book?
At the moment, I've only got one outlet in the States, which is Malt Advocate magazine, and they haven't... They're actually doing a lot of advertising, and I suspect they're going to run out of copies very quickly. The downside is that if people order from the website, which is really what I would like them to do, there's a sizable postage charge because the book is so heavy. But there are two versions of the book. There's the basic shrink wrap version, and there is a connoisseur's edition, which I've produced in a black linen slipcase with a limited edition print included in the book. So that's more expensive, but the postage on top makes a bit of a disincentive, but I hope it won't put people off. The actual book price itself, I've been told over and over again, is very reasonable for what it is. So hopefully the combination of the book and the postage is within people's budgets.
Ian's website is www.bottledhistory.com, and I've posted a link at the Whiskey Cast website. I also checked with the folks at Malt Advocate, and they do still have copies of Bottled History available for U.S. listeners. As I'm recording this, we're in the middle of a blizzard with about a foot and a half of snow on the ground so far, and as you might expect, I'm in the mood for peat. We'll start off the What I'm Tasting This Week department with what I'm tasting right now, some Ardmore 30-year-old. Ardmore was one of the distilleries that Ian featured in Bottled History. Distillery manager Alistair Longwell selected the casks for this cask strength bottling at 53.7% ABV. Ardmore is usually one of the peatier Highland whiskies, but the peat in this one only comes out with a splash of water. The nose also has hints of toffee, dried flowers, and a touch of orange zest. The taste is smooth and creamy with a mild peatiness that balances notes of toffee and vanilla. The finish is dry with a nice muted smokiness. It's an exceptionally well-balanced whiskey, and I'm giving the Ardmore 30 a 94. A few weeks ago in episode 226, we heard from Tomatin's Graham Nicholson about the distillery's new 15-year-old single malt. I tasted a sample of that this week, along with samples of the 12 and 25-year-old Tomatin malts. Let's start off with the 12, which may be one of the best buys among single malts. Park Avenue sells it for $26 a bottle. The nose is light and aromatic with notes of straw, malt, and apples. The taste is complex with a slight spiciness balancing out notes of malt, apples, hazelnut, and a touch of smoke. The finish is long and smooth with a nice maltiness, and I'm scoring the Tomatin 12 a 90. Turning to the 15-year-old, this one has a bit more sherry influence, but the nose is still clean and light with notes of peaches, orange peel, and vanilla. The taste is smooth with hints of honey, apricots, and oranges, and the finish has a slight kiss of spice with lingering honey notes. I'm scoring the Tomatin 15 a 91. Finally, the Tomatin 25 has a woody and resinous nose with hints of peaches and oranges. The taste is dry and nutty with notes of almonds and cashews that fade to reveal hints of honey and lemon that continue on the dry and very long finish. The Tomatin 25 gets a 93 in my book, and I was really impressed with all three expressions. Of course, you may find something completely different when you taste a single malt. You'll find all of my tasting notes on the ratings page of the Whiskey Cast website. That's also where you'll find links to the Whiskey Cast Facebook page and my Twitter feed, the Whiskey Cast store powered by Amazon.com, the sign-up link for the Whiskey Cast newsletter, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is www.whiskeycast.com. And my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@whiskeycast.com. Finally, I'd like to pass along best wishes for the holiday season and the new year to come on behalf of my entire family, my wife Christina, my daughters Brianna, Aria, and Tessa, and the sheepdogs, Frizzle and Bristow. Whiskey Cast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2009, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry, and this weekend snow-covered, town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening, and happy holidays.